Welcome to the Legacy Podcast. I'm Chris Wilmerding, your host. The show is a series of conversations with business owners about their beliefs and values and which beliefs and values they want to share with the next generation. If you want to be a guest on the show, simply wait until the end of this 20-minute segment and we'll provide a link. Simply sign in at that point and we'll be in touch with more information. Now, let's get on with the show. Hello, this is Chris Wilmerding, host of Legacy Podcast, or actually co-host, along with Paul Dio, also co-host of Legacy Podcast. And today's guest is Michael Jansen. Michael is chairman and CEO of City Zenith. Michael, welcome. You have an interesting business model, and we can't wait to hear your story.
Welcome, Mike.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So this is probably the most difficult question we like to ask people, which is, what do you do and what exactly is City Zenith? I'm being a little bit sarcastic.
Great. Well, thanks again for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and talking to such a wonderful audience. City Zenith is a software company based in Chicago. We are helping to pioneer a trend called digital twins, especially in the building industry, which is our focus. Digital twins are virtual replicas of physical buildings and infrastructure and all the data in and around them. And they get used for a variety of things, from optimizing design to construction to ultimately operations. That's our specialty. The uniqueness of what we do is that we specialize in urban scale digital twins, hence City Zenith. There are lots of different types of digital twins for things like factories, things like oil and gas refineries. Our focus is on buildings in cities. In particular, much of our work these days will be in the area of decarbonization, so helping cities, campuses, infrastructure to achieve their net zero goals using this type of technology.
Wow, that's really cool. Can you tell us a story of how you were inspired to come up with this business model? I'm sure, just before we go there, that you were inspired by Star Trek and holograms.
No, I was inspired by all of that. As far back as you can go. I mean, my first real experience with anything in the world of 3D and visualization was probably watching Star Wars as an 8-year-old with my grandfather in the theater. And my next major, I think, experience was as a student at the University of Cambridge in the Department of Architecture in the late 80s, when we had one mad scientist architect in that department who loved computers, which were unheard of in 1989, and presented to the group, and we were all making things with pastels and watercolors, this incredible computer image of a completely built project transposed onto a photograph of the site, and everyone just jaw dropped. And we knew that the world was going to change, right? That was my Steven Spielberg moment. When Spielberg saw, I think, the first dinosaur run across the screen on a computer, he knew that film was going to change. I think that was my moment. So, but the idea actually to move this forward stems from a previous business. My previous company was a company called Satellier, and it was really a large architecture and engineering support company that provided services to building industry companies, architecture firms, engineering firms around the world. We basically made all their digital 3D models. And we started with like 10 people doing this business. And then in the course of 4 years, we scaled to over 500 people, and Sequoia Capital came in, invested millions of dollars in the company, and got on CNN, CNBC, the whole thing. We were doing a lot of work. But by the end of that, we realized that I had to develop capabilities as a business owner in something like 30 or 40 different software tools. And it was getting incredibly unmanageable. And we began to theorize, isn't there, or shouldn't there be one platform for all of this? One kind of SimCity-like, but for real cities type of 3D, bring all the data and all these different disparate tools together to make that much more efficient. And that was the kind of aha moment that led to us spinning out a company that eventually became City Zenith. And the very first thing we did was hire the gentleman who created Google Earth, thank you, Sequoia Capital, to put us on this wonderful technology path in 2009. And we've been iterating ever since.
Wow, what a story. So it was Star Wars, not Star Trek. I'm just noting it for the audience. Excellent. So I'm sure, because I can almost read Paul's mind here, but I'm wondering, and he's wondering, Where does your passion lie? I mean, you mentioned being over Cambridge, and I think that was grad school, but it sounds like you're straddling design, software, architecture. Where does your true passion lie?
As an architecture student, my love of buildings from the time I was very young, I first enrolled at the School of Architecture at Yale, later on at Cambridge, and that was my first exposure to the whole subject of architecture. And the first time you can say I developed a love for it. But as very early in my career, I developed a specific love for cities. As a young man going to China in the early 90s, I worked for one of the first U.S. Sino joint venture architecture firms. That's 23. And every project we were doing was 6 million feet, 8 million feet, 14. It was city scale things. So wow. I developed an appreciation for large projects because of what was happening in Asia and how complex they were and how important they were going to be, because the world was going to build lots more of these as we got bigger and as populations grew. And I think that's what I realized, a lot that was also going wrong. You know, I was seeing bad examples. I traveled the world. I visited 100 countries. I visited cities that worked super well. And then I lived in places that didn't work at all. You know, I lived in parts of the world, 25 years I lived in Asia in developing countries. I traveled across more than 1,000 cities. And you get to, you know, look back and forth and say, wow, that was an amazing experience. That was super efficient. And I want to love that place. And the other place just doesn't work at all. And everyone's trapped because it doesn't work. And, you know, you do this again and again and again and again. And you develop a passion for these things, especially when you can see something working super well over here and something not working well all over there. And you know that can change.
Yeah. Interesting. Huh. So, that clarity, I guess, having seen what works and what doesn't, must be at times maddening, because you can't in some ways control that. But let's go back to Yale for a second. I'm curious, did you ever, wasn't there a really famous architectural professor named Scully? Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Scully.
And did you take courses there? We're just vetting you, Michael. We want to make sure that you're up to snuff.
That is so funny that you mentioned that, because that was the first course I ever took at Yale. One of the things that got me into the subject, my sophomore year, the first semester of 1988, I was an English major when I enrolled at Yale, and I was walking towards some course I was going to spec, and a classmate of mine was passing by, going to the direction on his way to a Vince Scully lecture, and he asked me if I wanted to tag along.
And that was it.
I went on, sat in the third row with him, and I took the class, and the rest is history.
Well, he's one of the rare breeds of professors, from what I heard. I just have a book signed by him, actually. But what I heard was that he's not only a brilliant architect, but he's also a great teacher, or was. Is that true?
Very much.
Is that
very much?
Very interesting combo. Sorry?
Yes, he specialized in stick and shingle style architecture, but it was the way in which he would talk about architecture that really, you know, enwrapped all of us. You know, he talked about its transformative power. He would raise his fist and pound the table in lectures, and, you know, he was just, you know, but you came out, you walked out of those lectures charged up, thinking that if you were an architect, you could change the world. I think that's what he communicated to his attendees, you know, his students.
Interesting. So, Michael, many successful business owners can point to a specific turning point, either a good experience, bad experience, something, a story that put them onto the current path of success. What was that for you? What was your story?
There were a couple of major turning points in the business that I could point to. One, of course, was the decision to spin it out in the first place, this company, and into focus on just building this wonderful platform company. Because at the time, Sequoia Capital and I were running a 500 person company, and we bought this little, it was like an adopted child that we weren't sure we even had a parent, right? And what happened was that, this is actually an important story maybe for any entrepreneurs listening out there, but we had a running business that was making $1 million a month, okay? One of the most famous investors in the world invested in it, and you know, it was doing great. I saw a ceiling coming, though. I saw that we weren't going to get much further. I thought we were saturating already, and we were getting ahead of ourselves. And I felt the future was somewhere else in this, it, actually in the software and data business and the tool business, not in the services business there. And that we could take this knowledge we were learning from all of these mega projects and make a tool that would make these projects better, you know, and that was the whole thesis. So when the recession hit, my previous business, the one that was 500 people, got hit very badly. And this one was really in swaddling clothes, so hardly able to walk on its own. And I had to make a very, very, very tough decision. Do I abandon this newly adopted child, literally, and focus on the struggling mastership, as it were, or do I abandon the mastership and do I spend all of my time on this newly adopted child? And let me tell you, that was, there was a fighting at the board level over this. But I decided that I stuck to my guns. I stuck to my beliefs. I knew that even though we were doing great, that there was a ceiling coming, and that just because the board couldn't see it, I could. I also didn't believe that we would come out of the recession the same way. And I felt that the real future was in this little child that we were raising, because I knew what the problems were. I didn't know how much time it would take to build the tool. I didn't know how much time it would take for the market to catch up to the idea, but I knew it was a big problem, and I knew that we could help solve it. So that was the key decision then.
What an amazing story. It seems like you're completely bereft of any fear of failure or risk, because that sounds like...
How do you process that? Knowing that you're making that decisive decision and everyone else is not necessarily on board. And like you said, you didn't know whether or not the market would catch up, because, you know, for example, there was broadband video, you know, in the 90s, but it didn't really catch wave until YouTube, right? So it's there's always that fear of, are you being too early, or, you know, are you timing it right? So what's your thought process behind that?
We had the same fear. Are we too early? Are we in the right market with this? Same concerns. And the way I processed it was that we knew that from the project experience we had that it was needed. We knew that we had the connections to get into the large projects to explore it. We knew we could eventually find people to build the right software. But there was a big step into the unknown. I think there was a time when I was the only guy, I think, that really understood what was going on. That was hard. I was able to bring the board in part along with me because they trusted me. And there were those who just felt like this was a bad decision. And in the end, what happened was that I had to think about the future of the company, where it was going, and to be able to stay that course and be consistent over that period of time as we pursued this. That took a lot of perseverance. What's happened recently is that when the company started to turn a corner and we started to announce large projects like we have, you know, working with the Orlando Magic, working with the U.S. military, things that we do today, some of those people from, you know, 8-9 years ago who got nervous back then have come back to me to basically say, you know what, we're glad you're doing great. We're sorry we were wrong. And, you know, how can we help? And so I think the most important thing I learned also is that even when people dissent on the board level, even shareholders pretend you don't understand what you're doing, always be gracious. Always explain what you're doing and always be understanding. And because I was that way with everybody, even those who didn't quite get it or believe in it, you know, today we have such a healthy shareholder community, from people who invested back in 2009 to people who invested last week. And frankly, we need all of them.
It's funny. Let me shift tracks a little bit here. Going back to your business model, you can't be the only player in this particular field. So what's the one thing? You only get one choice here, Michael. What's the one thing that your company does better than 95% of the competition?
Today, we aggregate more of the data tools and services for these large-scale mega projects than any other of our competitors by far. And that is why we get appointed in so many large-scale projects. the way in which the market is shaken out is that proprietary companies are tending to stick to their unique tool sets that they've been using for years. We went in and positioned ourselves in between all of these companies and integrated project after project all the major tool sets and data services, which makes it the easiest for us to do a complex, large-scale project. That's where we're unique today.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, I want to go back a little bit to your discussion, Paul's, and your discussion about timing, which I thought was really interesting. You remind me, Michael, of another guest that we had who was one of the earliest German-based ISPs, and he tells this wonderful story. He now works at a VC, but he in the U.S., actually, Southern California. He tells this wonderful story of being offered something like $1 billion, just literally days before the stock transaction. So they were going to be merged into a publicly traded company, and they were offered $1 billion. And just 2 days, they closed literally a week before the market started to tank. And they were derided, called idiots for settling for $300 million in cash or something like that. I mean, it was one of those stories. But anyway, this guy's super crazy smart. And not that you aren't, Michael, but this guy is just when it comes to Google and what Google's doing and the search area, he is, I think, light years ahead of what most of us, certainly Paul and me, put us in that category. But one of the things he says about investing on the VC side is that his approach is it's everything is about timing. Everything. Almost nothing else matters. You know, you just got to have a good concept, good model, good management, but timing is everything. Isn't that weird? I mean, that he would boil it down. I mean, most of us, we've been investing and doing that kind of stuff for many, many years, but I've never really had it so clearly nailed on that. Whether you buy it is interesting, but it does feed into your narrative, Michael.
Yeah, I don't agree that timing is everything, but I agree timing is the most underestimated thing.
Fair enough.
When people put a plan together, I think he's right. My last company, we were simply lucky to have walked into the right party at the right time with the right model and the right everything, literally, and we were artificially successful. We literally made money from month one. We never lost money. You could not conceivably have timed that better. This business, the timing was very different because we really had to help develop the digital twin market over the past few years and then position ourselves as a leader in that development in order to then be where we are today. So I think, though, that when I look back on the timing issue, could we, as a small company as we are, or as we were at the time, have started today? No. I think that we would not be mentioned in conversations with Siemens and Bentley and Microsoft the way we are today in the digital twin side, unless we started a decade ago. I've been working on this for a long time. So I think that what the lesson for me was that I misunderstood that my last business, that everything you touch turns to gold overnight. And you just expect immediate success from something just because you're doing the right things. What I learned with building a software company was that it's a different actual business. The importance of, say, for example, marketing in my previous business was not that big a deal. Sales, sure. I mean, strategic sales, but in building a technology company and getting adoption, being able to create awareness about something, that becomes a significant part of what you do as much as doing what you do, right? So I think for me, it was a really interesting lesson all along. Plus, you have the fact that the world's changing around you. So because of COVID, suddenly, that kind of accelerated the digitization of communications and including buildings, and which is also what digital twinning is. It's a digitization of the built environment. So then these things happen on top of you. See, there's your timing, and then the things influencing timing. But
so timing, yes. So timing is important. I loved how you restated, and I'm sure you said it far better. You interpreted secondhand what that guest was trying to articulate, or was articulating, and so badly communicated by me. Just as a quick side note, it's really fun. Paul, I'm sure, noticed it. It's fun to see really successful entrepreneurs like yourself express humility. And I don't know, I'm not smart enough to figure this out on that note, but it's really encouraging, because it and I don't want to go down this rabbit hole but it's interesting. It must be a strength for successful business owners. I think if you don't have humility, or you have you've been shortchanged it, I got to believe that that actually makes things more difficult, because you're not recognizing the risk. You're not calibrating the risk. How about that? You're not assessing the situation. Yeah.
That's very true. I think my even attitude towards humility has changed over my career. I think there were times when I was younger, in my 30s, when I probably didn't appreciate all the success I was having, and because the money was coming in and being pulled into, television stations to talk about your business, suddenly I was, I was not appreciating it for a while.
Yeah.
I think it was the experience of building another company from scratch, and realizing that no matter what you did last time means almost zero this time. It's a new challenge. You obviously come in very well prepared, but I had to really get humble and realize I didn't understand this. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that. And I'd have to learn again, and I would have to keep learning. So, and never forget, this is a privilege at the end of the day. This is a choice. So, the ability to pursue a dream of some kind, as difficult as that is, and to have people support you financially and, development wise and clients, and that's a dream. So I try to remember that even on my worst day, that this is still a dream.
Yeah. Right? You're lucky. And you're a fortunate cat.
Definitely. And even when it's hard, there are a lot of people behind it. And today, I guess what's changed is that I feel a lot more for the people who've supported us than I do for myself, because we have 4,500 shareholders now, lots of employees. In the old days, it was just, maybe I'm building this because I have an idea that needs to get out there. But now they're just so much beyond just me that I feel like I'm working on behalf of all these other people now. And that's a different motivation,
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Different responsibility too, I guess.
Different responsibility. It gives me a little different attitude as a CEO also,
Yeah.
It matters.
Yeah. So here's one of our favorite questions. Why is money important to you, Michael?
Good question. Over the years, money has only ever meant options for me. The ability to do things I wanted to do, the ability to see places I wanted to see, especially because I was a big traveler for much of my life. And the ability to realize things, the ability to take care of others. These are things that, for me, money does. It doesn't go too much further than that for me. I don't necessarily have an ambition to be worth billions and billions of dollars. I mean, if God willing that ever happens someday, wonderful. I would be the kind of guy who gave most of it away. I know that. I think that my life trajectory is such that I've learned that the things that really excite me are things like doing projects, creating, working with clients, building something. And insofar as money can enable some of those things, give me a job where I can do that and keep doing that, that's useful, So, but I'm not a collector. I'm not a person who when I made money for the first time, when Sequoia invested, I didn't change my lifestyle at all. I just think that that's me. So happy to make money for others, actually. I enjoy that. But that's how I see money.
Neat.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's this concept that I heard about. It's called ontological design, where it's basically the premise of, whatever you design designs you back. So it's the environment that you surround yourself with. So I think about that often, is it nature versus nurture? Is it something that we build that kind of changes us over time? So I could see that your path is kind of that's gratifying in itself rather than the ability to collect things.
I agree, especially, you know, Paul, in now that we're focusing a lot on the climate change issues in cities, that's become the focus on of the whole company. We launched a Clean Cities, Clean Future campaign to donate digital twin technology to key cities. New York is on board, Toronto, several. It'll be a really nice program. And now we're dealing with things which are things that, you know, as an architect, I've been interested in since the 80s, you know. When I came back to the States in the early 90s from Asia, I tried to get a job in the States. The first person I called was Bill McDonough in Virginia, one of the most, you know, renowned, you know, green architects. Then he was still the mad scientist. Later on, he became a genius everybody was chasing. But I tried to get a job with him. I tried to get a job with the mud hut sculptor, Mr. Hubble, out in the West Coast. I tried everything, you know, but I realized that because of my experience in Asia, where people live more naturally, gentlemen, where they, you don't have air conditioning for everything. You're not sanitized from the world around you. You live in the world around you. You know, there's a lanai right here. You're practically living inside, outside. So living more in with an immediacy of nature in your life. And you come back into the sanitized, you know, commercial buildings with controlled environments and whatnot. And you see that the environmental cost of creating these fake environments, which aren't so healthy. My whole interest began shifting that way. In healthy buildings, et cetera. And ultimately that manifests in healthy cities. So I'm kind of right where I want to be right now. The nice thing is that the world now is talking about climate change. You know, we received a letter of support from the C40 Climate Action League in 2013, but now the world is starting to talk about these issues. You know, the Biden presidency should have a major impact actually. So it is having an impact. And I think that we're hope in result to realize that ambition as well and put this technology to good use.
So, Michael, before we talk about the title with, you know, the subject matter of this interview, which is legacy, I have one question. We have one question, which is, what's the one thing you wish you could change in your business today?
Yeah, I think the one thing I just keep not getting out of my head is that I know that we now need to grow really quickly, you know, and the way the market's unfolding and the way the projects are coming to us, the one thing I'd like to change is to quintuple the size of the company by the end of March. You know, that really would help a lot. That aside, you know, I'm really happy with what's going on these days. We are raising money through a Regulation A plus capital raise, which is going terrific. Just crossed $2 million in record time. Clients are coming in, and they're wonderful. You know, can't complain at all. So all that's just going fine. But my concern is, how are we going to do this? I've been there before. You know, you can have a lot of problems. You know, clients will walk away if you can't serve them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues around organizational growth. People say, oh, double in size. That's a lot of work. Okay, people have really done that. Know that kind of hiring and training and retaining and rapid sequential culture change is a lot of work. So I've done that before, and that's not easy. So I would fast forward to that point.
I kind of, you raised so many different interesting thoughts there, but I wonder what the role is of collaboration in leveraging your time and your firm's time. And that's a discussion for another time, but it's just kind of interesting if you wanted to quadruple and you really weren't all about controlling everything, you might be, and there's nothing wrong with it. Controlling the quality of the software and the product and et cetera and the experience. But I wonder what you could do to tap into the person power and the skill set and the collaboration brings.
We'd have to.
What's that?
We'd have to.
Yeah. The only way to get there. All right. So on to the topic of legacy, Michael. When you think of the word legacy, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Really, what you leave behind.
Yeah.
That's really it. What you leave behind for others to, in some way, use, appreciate, enjoy, or learn from.
And so what is it that you want to leave behind, since you teed that up for me?
what I really would love to do is to not just make the company financially and commercially successful using the model that we have, which is working with these large scale partners and doing projects all over the world. But I really think that as a legacy, I would like to have the world cities actually use this technology for the purpose of decarbonizing. I really think that it is the right technology. I really, really do. And we're working with models right now that, aside from the firm's ordinary commercial work with groups like the 2030 District, which is a collection of 23 cities in America and their building owners who all commit to lowering emissions by 2030. And they're looking for a platform to make that possible, right? They have most of America's major commercial buildings are inside the 2030 district areas. And I would love if someday those major American cities used that and American building owners were able to decarbonize in an economically sensible way that then impacted the districts in which they live, because that whole process basically is going to greenify the downtowns of urban cores across America. That would be a legacy worth leaving, you know?
Yeah.
And believe it or not, it's not impossible.
Yeah. Well, I think things are moving along more and more quickly these days. It's pretty remarkable. And I don't think human beings are very good. Their brains are not designed to watch stuff that compounds or in terms of, you know, that kind of mathematical speed. And I think we're seeing that in so many different spaces of our lives these days.
And it must be interesting getting a sample size of what it looks like with no employees in a building for 3 or 4 months at a time. So as far as the carbon impact during the pandemic. So it's interesting.
What specific actions or steps can you share with our audience to help them build a lasting and meaningful legacy? Do you have some thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's you know, it's very individual, I suppose, you know, or the answer would be very individual, you know. I think that though, it has to come from a place of authenticity and integrity, something that you truly believe in, whatever it is, whether you make music or you, you share your thoughts with the world through a podcast or you run a country, you know, it has to come from that place. And if it does, at some point, if you get good at it, at least when I crossed 50, you know, I began to feel like I needed to teach this to someone, you know, and I think that's natural for a lot of people, right? So just go with that urge when it comes. It'll give you the guidance you need to figure out what your legacy is supposed to be. It might just be transferring it to your children. Mm. You don't know. But yeah. I mean, go with that urge when it comes, whenever it does. Mm. And then, you know, it'll come naturally.
That's a great answer to a tough question. Michael, it's been a great pleasure to have you as a guest on our show. And we're really excited to share your story with our audience. Before we sign off, I want to mention to our audience that if you want to be a guest on our show, Legacy Podcast, please go to businesslegacypodcast.com. That's businesslegacypodcast.com and book your interview there. Thank you, Michael Jansen, Chairman and CEO of City Zenith. Yeah. There we go.
You nailed it.
The third time. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you for being a guest on our show.
Chris, Paul, thank you very much. It was an honor.
Wow. Michael, yeah, thank
great.
You.
That was great.
Yeah, boy, did you go in 450 directions. And we've had some deep thinkers on this show, but that you're up there. You're a competitor in that category. Thanks for listening to the Business Legacy Show. If you're a thoughtful business owner who would like to be a guest on this program, please visit businesslegacypodcast.com/guest. That's businesslegacypodcast.com/guest. Now, if you got something out of this interview, please share this episode on social media. Just do a quick screenshot with your phone and text it to a friend or post it on the socials. If you do that, tag us with hashtag Business Legacy Podcast. Again, hashtag Business Legacy Podcast. Each month, we scour Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. We pick one winner from each platform, and you get crowned king or queen of that social media. What do you win? We're going to promote you and your business to our audience of over 150,000 people, totally free. Now, can you hook us up in your podcast player right now? Please give us a thumbs up or a rating and a review. We promise to read it all and take action. We believe that a person's legacy is the most important thing someone can leave the next generation, and your feedback helps us fulfill our mission. And while you're at it, hit that subscribe button. You know why? Because every week for 15 minutes, you are going to be inspired and motivated to leave a lasting and meaningful legacy. My name is Chris Womerding. Let's connect on the socials. You'll find all the stuff we're doing at businesslegacypodcast.com. Again, businesslegacypodcast.com. Thanks for listening, and thank you for being part of the Business Legacy Movement.